Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is North American energy worse for the environment than what we import from faraway places? The U.S. brings in more of its oil from Canada than from any other foreign country. And Canada is believed to possess the second largest reserve of petroleum on the planet. But not all oil is created equal. Canada's supply comes mostly from bitumen found in Alberta's tar sands, so it doesn't just gush from the ground as liquid. It requires intensive processing in Midwest U.S. refineries that critics say pollute the air and water. And they say tar sands oil pumps far more carbon into our fragile atmosphere than the fuel we harvest in a liquid state. So what can we do about it? Andrew Nikiforuk is a journalist who writes about economics and the environment. His latest book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. Andrew, welcome to Think.
Hi there, Chris.
Will you start by giving us a good definition of bitumen and talk about where and how it's found?
Well, it's a pretty messy hydrocarbon. There are deposits in 70 places around the world. But, you know, two of the really largest deposits are in northern Alberta, and that's the tar sands, and the other major deposit, of course, is in Venezuela. Now, the thing about bitumen is that it's a pretty messy thing. I mean, it's the deposit in northern Alberta is about 300 million years old, and it's been badly degraded by bacteria. So all the light oil has been taken out of it. And what you have is this messy, thick, tarry substance that's really rich in carbon atoms and very poor in hydrogen atoms. So it takes a lot of energy, to number one, to take this stuff out of the ground because you can't pump it. And and then you've got to upgrade it. So and then once you've upgraded it, then you've got to put it through a complex refinery before you get anything like gasoline or jet fuel. So this is why industry calls it unconventional or difficult or ugly. Or just plain dirty, because its footprint is whether it's in terms of water intensity, energy intensity, carbon intensity, is just so much greater than that of conventional oil.
Yeah, 2 to 6 times greater than light oil.
Yeah, in terms of carbon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is what's interesting about this, Chris, is that nobody's really done the proper study on well to wheel emissions, the life cycle emissions for carbon from this project. I mean, this is the world's largest energy project, and we don't have this data. But from what I've heard from people who work in the tar sands, it kind of works like this. I mean, the amount of carbon per barrel, let's say, coming from light oil, let's say in the North Sea, is around 10 kilograms. And I'm sorry, I'm on the metric system.
That's
here
okay.
In Canada.
We studied in school. We just don't talk about it.
That's right. And for the tar sands, in contrast, it ranges in the mining operations from 50 kilograms per barrel to up to 300 kilograms per barrel. So, I mean, there's a real difference there, and it all depends on the deposits and how much natural gas you're using, and how, what the energy intensity of that particular reserve is.
And can you talk about, you mentioned that we can't just pump it. What does it take to get this stuff out of the ground?
Well, it takes what I call brute force. I mean, this stuff is so difficult to get out of the ground that at one time in the 1960s, the Alberta government was looking for kind of the cheap and easy way to produce the product. And so somebody suggested, well, why don't you just nuke it? And it was actually a geologist an American geologist from Saudi Arabia, and who suggested it. And the Alberta government thought, well, that's a good idea. Why don't we, let's set off a nuclear device right under the ground in Fort McMurray with the idea that, you'll create this cavity and all the bitumen will melt and pool in one place, and then you'll pump it like regular oil. So they took the idea to the American government, and the American government said, that's a great idea. We'll give you the bomb. And then they went to Atlantic Richfield, and they said, sure, we'll find a location for it. Now, in the end, saner minds prevailed. The Russians did the same thing, and they said, but they actually went to the whole end process of setting off a bomb, only to discover that there's no market for radioactive oil. But I mean, that gives you an idea of how difficult this stuff is to produce, that you'd even think about nuking it. But there are two ways now that we produce this stuff. One is trucks and shovels. So it's a brute force open mining approach to extracting the shallow deposits. And the deeper deposits, we steam out of the ground. We actually heat the ground up to 250 degrees Celsius with lots and lots of steam, and we melt the bitumen, and then we collect it and pump it to the surface.
And in those cases, it's 3 barrels of oil for every 1 barrel, 3 barrels of water, rather, for every 1 barrel of oil.
That's correct.
Yeah.
For the mining process, it takes about 3 barrels of fresh water per barrel of bitumen, and that's an extraordinary amount of water. And on average, I mean, industry is using every year enough water really to supply 2 cities the size of Calgary with you know, everyone's water needs.
And when you talk about open mining, Andrew, I think instantly of the kind of tailings that must be left behind.
Well, the tailing problems are absolutely immense, and the problem sort of comes from this way. Okay, once you've used a truck and shovel operation to get the bitumen out of the ground, then you have to separate the bitumen from the sand and clay that it's trapped into. And the process they use is a hot water process. So it's kind of like you take this messy, tarry stuff and you throw it in a huge washing machine, and you add a bunch of caustic soda, and the bitumen kind of frosts to the surface, and then you've got the sand and clay, and you've got all this wastewater. Well, for 40 years now, we've been putting the wastewater in so-called tailings ponds. Really, they're the size of lakes. And they are among the world's largest impoundments of toxic waste on the planet. I mean, one of Syncrude's tailings dams is second in size in terms of construction material and volume, only to the Three Gorges Dam in China. That's how big these things are. And so they hold lots of waste, and the waste is, and what industry does is that they will recycle a lot of this water, and in which they make in so doing they make the problem worse, because every time you recycle the water, you concentrate the salts, the ammonias, the chlorides, and all the other stuff. So the ponds now are extremely toxic. I mean, they've got naphthenic acids, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, cancer-making, fish-killing stuff. As well as cyanide and arsenic and all kinds of heavy metals. So if any of these ponds were to break or to breach, we'd have, a real disaster in the Athabasca River. And on a scale about 3,000 times larger than the Exxon Valdez. So this is a huge issue for the tar sands.
And in terms of wildlife, Alberta is hardly a wasteland. There are a lot of valuable species living there.
Yeah, well, Alberta has got, northern Alberta is basically a boreal forest, although rapidly it's becoming an industrialized parking lot. I mean, the area that you can find bitumen in northern Alberta covers approximately the area of Florida. And so really what we're proposing to do is to industrialize an area the size of Florida to provide energy security for both Western Canada and much of the U.S. Midwest. And we're not saying that we're going to dig up that whole area of Florida, because the open pit mines, basically will only occupy an area about the size of New York City. That's 3,000 square kilometers. But the rest will all be, dotted with steam plants. And so we'll fragment this forest with pipelines and with well pads and roads and seismic lines. And to such a degree that about 80% of the wildlife living there, including bears and lynx and woodland caribou and boreal songbirds, will be pretty much blasted out of the region.
And right now there is very little regulation in terms of well density. So, in other words, these sites are, as you mentioned, maybe only take up the space of New York City, but they can be close together and causing problems far beyond their actual reach.
Well, most of the open pit mines are side by each. I mean, it's like building small cities right next to each other. And, and that's where the deposits are. The problem has been is that we haven't, sort of sequenced any of these developments. I mean, since 1996, we've approved more than 100 tar sands projects, whether open pit mines or whether the steam plants. And that's way too many. And we haven't, as a result, we haven't kept up with the environmental implications of developing too much too fast.
You have argued that bitumen or bitumen, however you choose to say it on which side of the border, costs taxpayers more than whatever benefits are generated from the sale of that oil.
Yeah, the costs of doing this are absolutely huge. I mean, right now the tar sands are the world's largest energy project, and so more than $200 billion in the last decade or so has been poured into this project, with the result that we have phenomenal social and economic problems in Canada. In Fort McMurray, per se, I mean, we've got your typical boomtown. And in many ways, I mean, Fort McMurray resembles, Deadwood in the Dakotas in the 1870s. I mean, there's a housing crisis, there's a prostitution crisis, there's a drug crisis, there's a labor crisis, you name it, and Fort McMurray's got it. And then on top of that, on a national level, I mean, we've now got a petrodollar in Canada. We don't seem to be very good at saving the money or even identifying the proceeds so that they can be saved. We're shifting labor patterns in the country. We've got 340,000 people from Atlantic Canada have moved out west to take part in this tar sands boom. Our manufacturing sector has suffered greatly as a result of having this petrodollar. So the costs are really adding up there.
And for now, very few of those costs are actually worked into the price of a barrel of this oil once it's been refined.
That's absolutely true. That's the kind of accounting we just don't do yet anywhere.
Hmm. How much of this oil is the U.S. consuming every year?
Well, about 18% of the oil that the United States now imports is coming from Canada. And of that 18%, 10% is directly coming from the tar sands. And there are about three regions of the country now that are really dependent on this resource. The first is the U.S. Midwest, so that's Petroleum Administration Defense District Number 2, and that's Barack Obama country. That's Illinois and Michigan and Minnesota and Ohio. And then much of Utah is running on bitumen, and about 10% of Washington State is now running on bitumen as well. So the United States is becoming increasingly reliant on, this so-called dirty oil. And only, I'd say, only about 2 out of 10 Americans are even aware that they're the major oil supplier to the United States is now Canada.
So if I read this right, more than 65% of the overall output of Canadian oil is sold to the U.S. Is domestic demand for oil also on the rise in Canada?
Oh, yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on the rise because the tar sands is such an energy-intensive project. I mean, you can't develop something as dirty as the tar sands without burning an awful lot of oil in the process. I mean, a lot of the guys that work in Fort McMurray are on ships, so they'll work for 2 or 3 weeks in Fort McMurray, and then they'll be flown back to Newfoundland or to Cape Breton Island or to northern Manitoba or to northern Saskatchewan for a week off, and then they'll be flown back again. I mean, the whole project is hydrocarbon intensive in every which way you think about it. I mean, Fort McMurray is, your typical boom town. It's a place where people spend an awful lot of hydrocarbons. I mean, just about every family has got an ATV and a motorcycle, a boat, a snowmobile, and a couple of trucks parked outside.
So how much have Canada's greenhouse gas emissions increased in the past couple of decades?
Well, they've grown a lot. I mean, the tar sands is kind of a greenhouse gas volcano for the country. Because on average, I mean, the tar sands, I mean, is producing 20 to 30% more greenhouse gases than conventional oil. So the tar sands project has become this kind of carbon-making nation within a nation. So we are now producing more greenhouse gases and climate warming stuff in Fort McMurray than the entire nation of New Zealand. And right now it accounts for about 4 to 5% of our national emissions. And if we increase production from 1 million to 3 million barrels a day, which is really where regulators and industry and government want to go, then the amount of stuff coming out of Fort McMurray will be about 15% of Canada's natural emissions, and that's a huge problem.
Andrew Nikiforuk is here. His new book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. You can join us after the break by calling now, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is environmental and economic journalist Andrew Nikiforuk. His new book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Andrew, what sort of role does the Canadian federal government play in the regulation of the oil industry in Alberta?
Well, that's a good question, Chris. I mean, it kind of plays at this point in time a very conflicted role. I mean, the federal government of Canada makes the most money from rampant tar sands development. It makes, on average, about $5 to $6 billion a year in corporate taxes. And it doesn't save any of that money, and none of that money is put into a sovereign fund. So as a consequence, we've kind of created a petro-state in Canada, and our prime minister is from Alberta, is from an oil-producing region. He is the son of an Imperial Oil executive. Imperial Oil, has among the largest interests in the tar sands of any oil company. And he's not, Prime Minister Stephen Harper also isn't a big believer in climate change. So we have an administration in Canada that is extremely hydrocarbon-friendly, and has been reluctant, really, to regulate this project in any manner, and has also been reluctant to kind of get renewables going in the country, or even to come forward with a truly effective and cost-effective climate change program. We haven't got one.
So you mentioned Prime Minister Harper. He has called Canada an energy superpower, which seems, I suppose, an appropriate term at this point. Can you talk, though, about how the tar sands oil projects have affected national security in Canada?
Well, you can't become the number one supplier of oil to the world's mightiest empire without... without affecting a whole bunch of things, and security is certainly an issue. I mean, we just recently formed a special detachment of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, whose primary concern at this point in time will be protecting oil and gas infrastructure, and largely oil and gas infrastructure that's headed south, that is supplying, U.S. markets. We've had a number of issues in Fort McMurray. There was even, during 9/11, there was a riot at one of the work camps up there because a number of the cooks, who I take it were Muslims, were cheering as the planes were going into the towers, and so there was a riot that resulted as when that happened. So, I mean, there are a number of security concerns. Just the fact that some of the world's longest pipelines, oil pipelines, extend from Canada to the United States is a major one. I mean, they're largely indefensible.
Is it true that there are no strategic oil reserves held in Canada?
That's true. We do not take oil and store it and put it in salt formations or wherever and then hold on to it for the future. We have no strategic reserves.
Why not? Is there just no political will for that when there was money to be made?
There's no political will for it at the moment, and we could have. We're running a just-in-time oil economy here, and the whole emphasis has really been on the export of oil to the United States.
My guest is Andrew Nikiforuk. His new book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Kevin in North Richland Hills. Hey, Kevin.
Good afternoon. Interesting discussion you have. I'm an expat Canadian that lives down here in the States. And I just have a couple questions on the math. I'll listen off the air for the answers on the math on the greenhouse gas emissions and how you say it's going to triple in output. Isn't there going to be some basis of economy of scale? Because they've been trying to get the oil out of the tar sands for decades now. It's not just a boom town, as you might have the boom town mentality. Is definitely that. But they've been at it for decades now. Isn't there going to be some basis of economy of scale because they have so much infrastructure basically in place? And isn't the other thing on the greenhouse gas is, isn't Alberta one of Canada's largest beef supplier? More cattle there than anywhere else in Canada. And doesn't that add to the greenhouse emission?
Thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks.
Andrew?
Yep, those are good questions. And basically, I think the caller is asking, or Kevin is asking about, given the economics of scale, won't greenhouse gas intensity go down in terms of per barrel production? And in fact, it is. But what is, but But the scale of the whole thing is expanding so rapidly that the drops in intensity aren't keeping up with the overall production. So we are actually increasing quite dramatically the volume of greenhouse gases. Now, the tar sands are not the only source of greenhouse gases in Alberta. By far, the biggest producer of greenhouse gases would be our coal fire plants. And yes, methane production in rural Alberta in cattle feedlots is also makes a substantial contribution, and which is an argument for basically for Alberta and for Canada to have a comprehensive plan that basically says that for every kilogram of carbon we're producing in the tar sands, we should be taking two off the table somewhere else, you know, wherever it makes the most economic sense to do so. And that's the kind of program we don't yet have in Canada that we should.
Yeah, and for now, my understanding is that a lot of those decisions are left in the hands of the individual provinces.
They are. Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, then there hasn't been a heck of a lot of agreement yet between the feds and the province about how to really achieve effective targets for reducing carbon emissions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line in Caddo Mills, we have Bruce. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, ma'am. What countries are the major suppliers to the United States, and what percentage do they supply?
The major suppliers of oil?
Oil, yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Canada is number one.
Canada is number one, and Mexico is number two, Saudi Arabia is number three, Venezuela is number four, Nigeria is number five, and then comes Iraq, Algeria, Angola, Russia, and Brazil.
Is there reason to believe that adjusting those numbers would fix the problem, or do you think Canada would find another market instantly for this oil that it's sending to the United States?
Well, right now Canada only has one market for this oil, the United States, and there's a great deal of concern in Canada at this point in time about the fact that U.S. mayors and congressmen like Henry Waxman and the governor of California have all, you know, raised concerns about the quality of this oil and its carbon footprint. And so there has been talk about building a pipeline across British Columbia to the West Coast with the idea of providing China with a source of oil. Right now the United States really is keen on getting this oil. I mean, this is a critical part of the U.S. oil supply. I mean, Dick Cheney once referred to it as, you know, a pillar of energy and economic sustainability for the continent. But clearly there are other voices in the United States that are saying, well, wait a moment, we want to get off bloody oil, but is it such a good idea to really get hooked on dirty oil? And how stuck in the sand do we want to be? So, I mean, that's an interesting debate that is now working its way through the United States.
And we should say that you do believe that there is a place for using this oil, dirty though it is, in terms of as a step toward a much cleaner and carbon-free energy system.
Well, I mean, at this point, Chris, really, we don't have a heck of a lot of choice. We don't have any kind of renewable energy system really in place to substitute for oil on any major level. So at this point in time, the tar sands is an incredibly strategic resource. But what we need and what Canada needs, I think, and also what the United States needs, is some kind of 30-year plan that says, okay, well, you know, how much of this resource are we actually going to exploit, and at what social, environmental, and political cost to Canada? And are we going to use this resource to get to a low-carbon economy, or are we just going to use this resource to create kind of another Saudi Arabia in Canada and liquidate the thing as quickly as we can and not address these greater issues about, you know, just the America's problematic addiction to oil and what the consequences might be for Canada. I don't think it's either in Canada's interest or the United States' interest to create another Saudi Arabia, particularly one directly north of the border.
We have an email from Liz who says, I've heard that a new technology for extracting oil from tar sands involves burying large electrodes to heat up the bitumen without surface mining or using a lot of water. Do you know anything about this prospect and its feasibility?
Yeah, there's a number of pilot projects at this point in time that are experimenting with putting electrodes in the ground. Now, the question would be, okay, what would be their source of power? How are you going to provide the electricity to heat up these electrodes? And quite often these electrodes would have to heat up the deposits to very, very high degrees. I know there's an experimental project, let's say, for example, even in Colorado, it's a little bit different, but they're putting electrodes in oil shale, which is a product, you know, that is arguably much dirtier than bitumen. And, you know, and they're heating the deposit up to 600 degrees Celsius. So in order to do that, then you need a lot of electricity. And so there's increasing debate in northern Alberta as well as northern Saskatchewan about using nuclear power to produce bitumen. So unless you've got a clean or green source of electrical power, be it wind or geothermal or solar, to power this kind of project, then you're still going to have to deal with the greenhouse gas emission issue.
Let's go next on the phones to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hi, this is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Well, I used to get up to Fort McMurray with a fair amount of frequency, and one of the things that I saw that they were playing with was injecting carbon dioxide in as part of the SAGD process to extract the bitumen out of the oil sands. So that would be one way of trying to reduce the carbon footprint. I don't know where they're at with that right now. It's been a few years. The other thing that kind of struck me about the whole formation was it seemed like a giant oil spill, and that this oil was leaching into the river significantly from all the deposits. So in some aspects, it's almost like cleaning up God's oil spill. And then finally, I knew that at least Suncor is doing a fair amount of activity in renewable resource, specifically wind power. I'm not sure where they're at with that right now. I haven't checked up on it in the last year or two. Could you bring any of those comments to light?
Thanks for your call.
Sure, absolutely. Those are good issues. Yeah, there's been a fair amount of talk about burying CO2 and using it to for enhanced oil recovery in Alberta. Really haven't gotten anywhere yet with that idea in the tar sands. And part of the problem there is just the economics. I mean, it costs an awful lot of money to capture CO2 off a power plant or an upgrader. And a lot of the projects in the tar sands, particularly the steam plants, are small. So the economics of capturing, stripping CO2 and then using it for recovery of bitumen, it just hasn't really worked yet, and it's still in the experimental phase.
And where does the liability lie if something goes wrong with the carbon capture technology?
Well, you know, that's a good. I mean, Americans are having this big debate, too. Wyoming has decided the liability should lie with the injector, with the people injecting the CO2 in the ground. Other places are thinking, well, the liability should lie with taxpayers. Other people are saying the liability should lie with industry itself. You know, that's you know, and that's all up for grabs at this point in time. I mean, carbon capture and storage is a hugely controversial proposition, largely because it's because of the economic costs. And then there are a lot of really serious questions about how well it will work and a number of security issues in terms of, you know, whether this stuff will come back up to the surface. Now, the other question that your caller asked was, okay, well, isn't the tar sands really just this giant oil spill and industry is cleaning it up? Well, for sure. I mean, it covers a vast area. A lot of it is exposed, and a lot of it is you know, you can find this stuff seeping out of the ground all over Fort McMurray area and right into the river. But the industrial process to actually dig up the bitumen and produce it is a little bit messier than Mother Nature. And there are all kinds of issues with contamination, particularly from the tailings ponds, as well as, you know, leaks and spills and all sorts of stuff. So we're not just, you know, we're doing something more than just cleaning up an ancient oil spill. We're actually creating oil spills of our own. And then in terms of, you know, renewables, I mean, there are some companies, Suncor probably being the most progressive, that has made some investments in renewable wind power in the southern parts of the province, but they're not using wind power to produce bitumen. Nobody at this point in time is using a renewable source of power for tar sands production, strangely enough.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Brett in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
Great
show.
Thank you.
Good. Hey, I had just a question. I was wondering how Barack Obama's cap and trade or carbon tax would be levied against this, if it would be, you know, evaluated as a more heavy polluter than, you know, oil out of Saudi Arabia or something. That's my question. I look forward to your comment. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, there certainly is a lot of talk in Canada about what the cap and trade system might mean and what the penalties might be for exporting bitumen. And I think just about everyone expects at some point in time that, you know, there'll be added cost for this product. And then there are other people in industry say, well, really, there should have been added costs for bloody oil from the Middle East, too. But I think it's coming, and I think we'll find that there'll be a premium placed on bitumen and bitumen exports because of all of the environmental issues associated with its production. And, you know, people forget, but, you know, it's not just, you know, the environmental costs of producing it. This is the world's most capital-intensive hydrocarbon. I mean, it's about $100,000 per flowing barrel of oil a day, and that's really expensive stuff.
Is there any sense that a continued depression in the cost of oil per barrel will reduce production?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the financial meltdown in the United States has already removed from the marketplace a substantial demand for oil, almost equivalent to what the tar sands is now producing, 1 million barrels a day. So, you know, what the financial meltdown has reminded us is that oil pretty much runs the world economy at this point in time. And without oil, you don't have an economy, and vice versa. And this is something new and novel and unprecedented and probably pretty dangerous, too, to think that in the last 150 years, as we've become increasingly addicted to oil, oil has increasingly become embedded in the very nature of economic life.
Andrew, let me take a break and we'll be back in a minute. Andrew Nikiforuk is here. His new book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Andrew Nikiforuk, whose new book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Andrew, you were talking about the fact that oil is an inextricable driver of the world economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, in many ways, oil has also created the financial banking system that we have today. And, you know, I would argue that the financial meltdown that we've experienced, and I would say we're only in the third or fourth inning of it, is very much tied to the fact that when oil reached, $150 a barrel, that we hit a ceiling and we crashed a lot of things in our economy and demonstrated just how intrinsically linked oil is to capital formation and production. It's another reminder that peak oil is real and is going to present all kinds of challenges to our capital systems, not just to the basic consumption of energy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hello, Ronnie.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I think what the deal is we're still missing the big picture here. We have the technology to make cars that'll get 100 miles to the gallon. We have technology to turn cars into, like the hydrogen cars and things like that, that produce, instead of producing a noxious gas that kills people, it's water vapor. And I think that's what we're still missing the big picture in that sense. And I agree with your caller saying, or with your guest there saying that, you know, the oil is what drives our economic engine. But I think that in and of itself is what needs to change. We've got to figure out a way to, you know, meet the world's energy needs and still keep us all alive and not empty our pocketbooks at the same time. I also wanted to say thank you for taking my call, and I love your show. I listen to it every day.
Thanks very much for calling.
Well, I agree with your caller, absolutely. I think, I mean, when you have to depend on a resource as dirty and energy-intensive and capital-intensive as bitumen or as the tar sands, and really, I mean, this is Mother Nature's way of telling you that, hey, business as usual and on the energy front can't continue. We've run out of cheap oil. We've run out of light oil. And now we're scraping the bottom of the barrel, and you know, if we can't be running on this stuff and not making dramatic changes in our economy at the same time without really setting up the whole system for a fundamental collapse. So you know, one of the issues in Canada has been is that we've rapidly developed this resource without a fossil fuel conservation program, without really an effective climate change program, and without any real targets for renewables. So, you know, we're making ourselves extremely vulnerable to all sorts of things. And I would argue that really the United States shouldn't be buying this stuff and running on this stuff unless you're preparing yourself for the 21st century. I mean, running on bitumen is a bit like running on coal. It's a 19th century resource, and it doesn't augur well for the future.
Canada does have a thriving natural gas industry as well. What would happen to the country's economy if natural gas were really the major resource that it was able to sell as fuel, and if bitumen production were to fall off dramatically?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is how much natural gas we actually use to produce bitumen. We use enough natural gas every day in the tar sands to heat approximately 6 million homes. That's $10 million worth of natural gas a day, or that's about 5% of our natural gas supply a year. And that's a, you know, a lot of people in the natural gas industry say, well, that's, you know, that's a bit like taking the Picassos in a museum and throwing them in the fireplace to warm the place up. And they're saying, you know, why are you using this product, this valuable product, for producing something as dirty as bitumen? And it's simply, in Canada, it's simply a matter of the fact that using natural gas as a fuel cost for bitumen production is a tax write-off, so that's why we do it. But it is not a very smart use of natural gas. And, you know, we don't have as much natural gas in Canada as we think. We probably will be out of natural gas by 2028. So it's also a resource that we probably should think very carefully about. But right now, the majority of our natural gas is exported to the United States.
Let's go next on the line to Denton, where we will find Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I read about a nanotube technology using titanium oxide and I believe it was copper oxide. They use it to make CO2 into methane. I was wondering how that kind of technology and biotechnology to clean off the dirty oil could actually help us move towards a more sustainable use of oil and also fund more more clean ways to use the oil.
Okay, that's a good question. I don't know if I have a good answer for you because I really don't know much about any nanotechnologies and its applications in the tar sands. But there has been some really good research done on bacteria. And we know that bacteria actually, you know, ate up this deposit in biodegraded it and turned it into the, you know, the tarry kind of slush that it is. But I know that bacteria has, some labs have worked with bacteria, engineered bacteria that can eat bitumen and kind of turn it into methane. And, you know, that might have some promising applications that would certainly really diminish the, you know, the god-awful footprint this whole project has at this point in time. But in order to really take advantage of those kind of innovations, we have to slow down, and we can't increase tar sands production at the rate that industry and government has forecast from 1 million to 3 million barrels a day by 2015 or 2020. So in many ways, the financial meltdown has slowed things down and perhaps can give us good opportunities to explore you know, some innovative solutions to some of the many problems rapid development has created.
You have in the back of the book 12 steps to energy sanity, which starts, as all good 12-step programs do, with admitting there is a problem.
Well, we have to admit that we're addicted, right? You know, and we are.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the most important steps of the ones that you've identified in terms of turning this all around?
Well, probably the first step is you got to have a conversation. You know, you have to sit down and admit, you know what, I've got a serious addiction problem. I used to be addicted to bloody oil in the Middle East, and now I'm addicted to dirty oil from northern Canada. And, you know, what's that going to mean to my economy, my community, and my family? And, you know, the average American still doesn't know where their oil is coming from, and they aren't even aware of the fact that Canada is the number one supplier and that most of this stuff is coming from the tar sands. So that Americans have to have that conversation first.
Well, and I think, in fact, beyond that, a lot of Americans are comforted by the fact that oil is coming from either Mexico or Canada, which are allies.
Well, and it is comforting because you know that if you're buying, well, it's comforting to some degree. I mean, Mexico is no longer really a stable state, and one of the reasons it's lost a lot of its stability is that its oil supplies are quickly dwindling, and a very reliable source of revenue for the government of Mexico is disappearing. Canada, on the other hand, I mean, when you buy oil from Canada, you know you're not subsidizing a group of religious fundamentalists intent on your destruction, right? So, I mean, that's a comforting notion, but at the same time, you're buying a product that it takes 3 barrels of fresh water to produce, that has got 2 to 3 times the carbon footprint of conventional oil, that is incredibly energy intensive. So, you know, you're taking 1 barrel of oil to produce 5 in the mining sector and 1 to produce 3 with steam plants. And so, I mean, your return on your investment is getting less and less and less. So there are a whole bunch of signals here that you know what, okay, so it's comforting to know we're getting this from a friendly place, but it's an ugly process to produce it. So in addition to having that conversation, Americans have to think about, all right, so, you know, maybe switching from bloody oil to dirty oil is a bit like, you know, switching your mortgage from Countrywide Financial to Bear Stearns, you know, and that maybe that the idea is to get off oil altogether. And by altogether, I mean, you know, as a transportation fuel that we'll always be using oil in some form or other, but not in the way we're using it today. We're really wasting vast amounts of oil. So I think that's important because the more money that American multinationals or companies pour into tar sands, really that's less energy and less money available for renewable development in the United States. And money that stays in money devoted to renewables is actually, you know, revitalizing local economies because it's keeping your energy dollars there at home, and that's what decentralized renewable energy production is about. And right now, the United States is spending $400 billion a year on buying oil. Well, wouldn't it be interesting if at least, you know, you could start off by chopping $100 billion off of that every year and devoting it to renewable and renewable production in the United States? So, I mean, there's so many different things that the United States really has to think about here. And ultimately, I would argue that it's U.S. consumption patterns, U.S. energy policy, and U.S. climate change policies that will determine whether or not this resource in, you know, northern Canada, which, by the way, was first exploited by Americans and Joseph Howard Pugh in the 1960s, will become what you know, a lot of people in the Canadian government would like to see as the next Saudi Arabia, or whether it just becomes sort of, you know, what it really should be, what a lot of geologists and folks and environmentalists would argue is, you know, this is a second line of defense. If we make the mistake of thinking that we can run on bitumen the same way we ran on light oil, then we're going to be in big trouble environmentally and economically and politically in a very short order.
An email from Victor asks that you comment on the following statement. Until the U.S. sets a policy that keeps gas prices high and gives cars with alternative technologies a chance to be economically viable and investors the certainty necessary, nothing will change. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's an interesting idea, and I would agree with him. I think that we probably need a carbon tax, a generalized carbon tax that just goes on gasoline, and that is, you know, we work out a way to make it income neutral so it doesn't affect poor folks. But the idea being that, let's keep the gas price, the price of gasoline high here so that we are continuing to remind people every day that, you know what, we're running out of this resource and we need to make some serious changes in our lives.
Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the conversation in Canada right now, maybe removed from the boom towns of the oil fields? How are people discussing this issue?
Well, you know, ironically, most Canadians aren't even aware that Canada has become the number one oil supplier to Canada. But, I mean, some of the big debates we're having really concern the use of nuclear power for tar sands production. I mean, right now there are three different nuclear reactors, and we're talking about, you know, these are $12 billion projects each being proposed for northern Alberta, largely for bitumen production or for the export of electricity to the United States. So we're facing the prospect of actually becoming the world's very first country to use nuclear power, not to get off fossil fuels, but to actually accelerate fossil fuel production. And that's becoming a source of very heated debate in both northern Saskatchewan and in northern Alberta. And the other big conversation that we're having in Canada about this project is the use of water. Tremendous consumption of water and this huge issue about wastewater production in the tailings ponds. And so the Aboriginal people, the First Nations that live downstream from this project, are saying, hey, what's going on here? I mean, we're seeing deformed fish. We're seeing really unusual and extreme rates of rare cancers in the communities like Fort Chip. And so that there's some pretty, you know, heavy talk going on about what it really means to live downstream from the world's largest energy project and whether the federal government and the provincial governments are really doing their jobs in terms of monitoring the amount of contamination and seepage from tailing ponds into the Athabasca River.
You've recommended slowing down tar sands development and capping production finally at 2 million barrels a day. What does that change, that cap?
I think that cap would do a number of things. It would kind of say, you know what, guys, if we go any further than 2 million a day, then we're into nuclear power, then we're into, you know, really pretty grotesque water contamination of a huge scale, and we're into environmental problems that we really don't have the money or the smarts to know how to control. And the cap would also be a reminder to both the Americans and Canadians that, you know what, guys, this whole idea of increasing oil supplies forever is not working. I mean, we can keep on increasing the volume of oil that you have regardless of the cost, as long as people are willing to pay $150 a barrel. But that's not getting the message across. And the message that both Americans and Canadians really need to think about is that, you know, by golly, we have to reduce consumption here. And we have to figure out other ways of generating income and adding value to our economies other than burning oil.
Andrew Nikiforuk's book is called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. Andrew, really important stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.